Hey everyone, if you're like me, you're always thinking about how to develop good habits so that you're better than other people. Well, today's book is Atomic Habits by James Clear. Atomic Habits teaches lessons for building good habits and losing bad ones, but it didn't teach me the habit I thought it would based on the title, Uranium Enrichment.
And this is The Book Pile. Ira Robison says, "This podcast is stupid funny. Dave brings the stupid, Kellen brings the funny." Smiley face.
I feel like we did not come out equally in that review.
Hey, if this is your first time listening to the podcast, welcome. This is a comedy podcast about books, and we hope you'll subscribe. But if you're still on the fence afterwards, may I personally recommend you at least check out what I think are our absolute funniest episodes so far, which are The Seven Habits, a biography of Leonardo da Vinci, and of course, our roasts of the Twilight books. All right, and without any further ado, here are our five favorite lessons from Atomic Habits.
All right, lesson one, make the good habit easier to do. So one of my least favorite phrases right after, "I think you're a really great guy," is the phrase, "no pain, no gain." Because I feel like it taught millions of us, including me, that something has to be hard for it to be beneficial. Mm. And what he says in the book is, if you're trying to gain a good habit, try to make it as easy as possible. So for me, my personal example is books. Like, I love reading, but I'm very busy. Audiobooks make reading so much easier. And I've met people who think audiobooks are cheating because reading only counts if it's hard. And so sometimes I break all their light bulbs and tell them to make some candles because light only counts if it's hard. But genuinely, if I didn't have audiobooks, I would maybe read a tenth as many books. So he gives some examples of making good habits easier. Want to draw more? Put your pencils, pens, notebooks, and drawing tools on top of your desk within easy reach. Want to exercise? Set out your workout clothes, shoes, gym bag, and water bottle ahead of time. And I would add that exercise is way easier for me when I have a sport I just love because it stops being work. I think the American life expectancy probably went up 5 years when they invented pickleball.
Pickleball, otherwise known as easy tennis.
But harder ping pong.
The next time you play pickleball, you should bring an actual pickle and act like everyone else is doing it wrong.
My default in anything is to act like everyone else is doing it wrong.
I've gotten a similar mixed reaction from people when I talk about the fact that I listen to most books. The conversation usually starts with, I bring up that I have a podcast to a group of strangers. In my defense, it's usually when I'm doing stand-up. And usually they're impressed by the amount of reading that I have to do because that means at least a book a week. And so I mentioned that I listen to most of my books, and then the people aren't impressed anymore. But the crazy thing is, now I know all the stuff in the book. Like, does that still count a little bit? I do try and read most of the fiction that we cover because I have an appreciation for style and paragraph size and things that authors do deliberately for that reading experience. But if it's nonfiction, especially with this author who basically says halfway through the book he's not even really a writer, I think that gives you full permission to just hit 3x speed and blaze through a bunch of facts.
Marissa Baratarin on Twitter talked about how people have this disdain for audiobooks, but for most of human history, we learned orally. Everything was passed on via speaking. And in fact, they were suspicious when books were first introduced. So I love that the suspicion has now reversed, where it's like, you can't learn by listening to stuff. Anytime someone's complaining to me that I listen to audiobooks, I ask them to please write out their complaint or I won't take it seriously.
I'd love to talk to Socrates because I love that he was vehemently against the written word because it felt purer, just spoken one human to the next. But I would love to let him know, like, do you have any idea how little I would really know about your philosophy had it been passed on through a ridiculous game of telephone to the 21st century?
Right. Yeah, we only know what you said because Plato wrote it down. But for any purists out there, we can send you a paper transcription of this podcast word for word.
All right. Lesson two, focus on your current trajectory, not current results. So Jeff Clear, am I getting that right?
James Clear, the author.
Did I finally? Dang it. I was so close to finally remembering an author's name.
We should get a supercut of you mispronouncing every author's name.
Yeah, okay, Dave, Mr. J.K. Rowling for 30 years.
In my defense, she only wrote my favorite fiction books of all time.
I would second your defense that her last name literally has the word owl in it.
It'd be like if it were J.R.R. Eagles.
So the author, James Clear, he says, quote, I began to realize that my progress had very little to do with the goals I set and everything to do with the systems I followed. And he actually didn't begin to realize this because he credits the whole idea to Scott Adams, the creator of Dilbert. So I guess he began to realize it once he talked to someone else who had realized it.
It's like when I first read The Theory of Relativity and immediately journaled, I made a great discovery.
So one of Scott Adams' philosophies is this idea of systems being the focus and not the goals. So if a goal is the signpost that you set in front of you, the system is the daily system you design for yourself on how to get there. So if you're a coach and your goal is to win a championship, your system would consist of things like how do you recruit players? How do you manage the assistant coaches? How do you execute practices, etc.? I love this clarity, shifting our aim or our focus away from the platitudes that you see captioned under a picture of a whale. You know, how many times have we seen that in like a State Farm insurance office where it's like goals and then underneath, you'll never succeed without them or whatever it is. Like that whale has any idea what a goal is. So goals are good for setting a direction. Systems are great for getting there. So he says that goal setting perhaps has misplaced importance because of survivorship bias, meaning that like every gold medalist in the Olympics, when they give their next TED talk, they just explain the goals that they set for themselves when the reality is all those other Olympic losers had the same goal. So he postulates, if all Olympians have the same goal of getting the gold medal, if all job candidates have the goal of getting the job, then the goal itself cannot be what differentiates the winners from the losers. The real difference lies in the systems that they use to get there. So James Clear says that systems are how you decide to accumulate your daily progress toward a goal. Your outcomes are what he calls a lagging measure of your habits. So your knowledge is a lagging measure of your learning habits. Your clutter is a lagging measure of your cleaning habits. I would add that your jealousy is a lagging measure of your scrolling through Instagram and only following your peers who are more successful than you habit. But he says, ultimately, you get what you repeat. I'm going to put an asterisk on my previous statement that it's a goal of every Olympic athlete to get a gold medal, because one exception to that rule is Elizabeth Swainy. Do you remember that story?
Is she the one who kind of conned her way into the Olympics?
Yeah, she just took advantage of existing loopholes. She's an American, but she found that she was able to represent Hungary because her grandparents were Hungarian. And so she just skied all over the world in all of these tournaments that had 30 or fewer people, because your qualification to get into the Olympics is a point system. And if you're consistently ranking in like at least the teens, then your average is pretty good. And then specifically, there was one event where she placed 13th out of 15th. And it was only because she did zero tricks and two other people fell down. So she qualified to make it to the Olympic qualifications in the 2018 Winter Olympics in South Korea. If you haven't seen it yet, treat yourself. YouTube Elizabeth Swainy and watch her ski down the half pipe doing zero tricks. The commentators have no idea what to do as she's just sort of making her way all the way down.
It's so funny and disrespectful. I'm just so curious what her goals were. Like, did she think it was funny? Did she think it was impressive? Like, what was her mentality?
I watched two short interviews with her, and it seems like she genuinely just wanted to wear the shirt. It's like, at one point she says, I'm so proud to come here and represent Hungary. It's like, yeah, speak Hungarian, though. So my takeaway is set a goal, but then let it take the backseat while you dedicate more time to design your best daily systems.
All right, lesson three. Make the bad habit harder to do. So he tells this story of this store owner in the 1800s whose store was losing money because his employees kept stealing from him. And instead of trying to shame his employees into not stealing, he just went out and bought a cash register. And so now all of a sudden the bad thing became way harder to do, which is why at home I keep all my junk food in a cash register. But there's this great quote in the book where he says, when scientists analyze people who appear to have tremendous self-control, it turns out these individuals aren't all that different from those who are struggling. Instead, disciplined people are better at structuring their lives in a way that does not require heroic willpower and self-control. They spend less time in tempting situations. So like, if Edward is worried he's going to eat Bella, maybe stay out of her room at night. But some real applications, the book The Premonition talks about how no one plugs 120-volt plugs into 240-volt outlets because they make the plugs different shapes, so the bad thing is impossible. Mm. Or in daily life, if you're worried about driving drunk, you can take an Uber to the bar, or also don't go to the bar. For me, in terms of making bad habits harder, I have a habit of scrolling social media too long. I'm pretty unique. And so I only log in on incognito, which means I have to re-log in with my long passwords every single time. Mm-hmm. And so I end up using it less. And I've also set up this really nice system for myself where if I eat too much sugar, my immune system attacks my body and I can't walk. Another small thing, if I'm worried I'm going to forget to take something to work, I just put my car keys on that thing so it's impossible to leave without it.
I have to do that in hotel rooms. I'm very forgetful. I used to have a terrible habit of just locking my hotel room key in the room. And so now I take the room key, and if I can't balance it on top of the door handle, I lay it right there next to the door.
That's why when I get to a hotel, I swallow the room key.
I do the same thing. Like if I've got my toddler in the car, to avoid an instance where I forget that he's in the back of the car, I don't even put him in the car seat. I just sort of jam him up next to my door so that when I get out, he's right there.
Balanced on the handle.
That was crazy to me to find out. I look at cash registers completely different at this point. Like when I'm in Target and I see the cashier, I'm like, that's more for you than it is for me.
I'm going to make a cash register that doesn't pop open until the cashier has actually been shot by the robber.
All right. Lesson four. Better to do less than you'd hoped for than to do nothing at all. Unless you're a serial killer. So this goes back to what I said before about our hyper-focus on the idea of the goal. When maybe that goal should just be treated as a signpost that sets the direction while we focus on more important daily things. And that daily thing doesn't have to start big. It just has to start. So he tells the story of a friend of his who hated going to the gym so much that when he finally buckled down to start losing weight, he made a goal to just stay at the gym for 5 minutes, which is what he did for weeks. And after that, he shaped up his goal. But the important thing was more the habit he was instilling, the identity of, I am a person who goes to the gym 3 times a week. That idea that, you know, 2 pushups a day is still better than no pushups a day. The one time that I went to the gym for only 5 minutes, I was using this device that's essentially just an elevated set of armrests that you support your whole body just by your elbows, and you swing your legs up and down to do stomach exercises. So there's a few of those things lined up in front of where everyone else is doing yoga. I get on one, I start swinging my legs up. I'm listening to Rage Against the Machine. And I don't know if you've ever done any sort of stomach exercises, but at one point, less than 5 minutes in, I had a sensation that maybe my body had just done something that made sound. But I didn't know because of the song I was listening to. Again, there's someone doing downward facing dog 3.5 feet away from me. So I just stopped in the middle of my set of reps and I ran out of the gym.
A good way to end a 5 minute gym session while saving face is to fake an emergency phone call and be like, "Hello, the president?"
One thing that has worked for me before that I just started doing again, I started counting calories again because I have 25 pounds that I want to lose and I've done it once before. It's been an effective way for me to lose a couple pounds a week, but I absolutely have a cheat day, which is sort of like a built-in relapse, and it's okay because it's still progress. So I am a proponent of this principle of like that it can be more effective in the long term if the consistency is still there, even if your plan isn't perfect or even if it isn't what you pictured in your head. Instead of saying I'm quitting soda forever and committing to that for 2 months, then binging again and quitting the quitting, I just give myself permission to commit what is technically less than the ideal, but eating better 6 days out of the week. Still better than eating healthy 0 days out of the week, which is what I've been doing for the past 19 months.
I think there's a couple reasons why this method works. And he applies it to a few things where he says, don't make your starting goal work out for half an hour. Just make your starting goal work out for 1 minute. And then if you want to go longer than that, great. And I think it's beneficial for a couple reasons. One is that so many times with habits, the hardest part is just starting. And once you start the activity, it's so much easier.
Yes.
And then another is something I realized with my writing. I used to be this very like precious writer and I would write when the conditions were absolutely right. And I held my writing days to such high standards until I realized if I write once a week and it's 10 pages, that's less than if I just wrote every day and it was 2 pages. Huh. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The thing that seems flawed and smaller is actually helping me more just by virtue of consistency rather than these big marathons and very scattered days.
Mm-hmm. Like I said before, I don't recommend this for absolutely everything. If you're trying to quit cocaine, once a week can still kill you. But
if you're trying to spend time with your kids, 2 minutes a day will do it. That's a great place to start.
But again, like you said, it's often the starting that takes the most energy. It's actually one of the laws of physics that moving something from a stationary place takes more of the energy than it does to just keep it going. And I know, again, from past experience, that once I got 2, 3, 4 weeks under my belt, so to speak, for losing weight, and I see those numbers headed down, then that's the momentum that carries me forward. But that initial starting point is always just so hard. So why not make it minimal just so you can get going?
That's why we're ending the podcast here. We are imperfect, and that's enough. All right, lesson 5, use social pressure. So this is a short one. He talks about how...
So Dave, do you want to drink some beer? The rest of us are doing it.
He talks about how if you want to develop a good habit, surround yourself with friends who have that good habit because our behaviors are contagious. And I was just thinking that my life right now doesn't have enough contagion. So for me, I have a hard time staying disciplined on solo projects. So right now, I've made sure all my projects are collaborations with you, Kellen, and my friend Natalie, and my brother and sister and other friends. And knowing that if I don't hit a deadline, my friends and family suffer is super motivating. It's almost like I gave myself hostages. There's also an entrepreneur he mentions in the book who wants to wake up at 5:55 every day. So he has a tweet scheduled to go out at 6:10 every day unless he's awake to cancel it that says, "It's 6:10 and I'm not up because I'm lazy. Reply to this for $5.
So I love the story that he tells. A World War II pilot, Roger Fisher, who post-war, he graduated from Harvard Law School and spent 30 plus years in negotiation and conflict management. He had this idea to make presidents more responsible with the football, you know, with the nuclear codes. Yeah. And he said his idea was, quote, put the nuclear code number on a little capsule, then implant that capsule next to the heart of a volunteer. The volunteer would then carry with him a big, heavy butcher knife as he accompanies the president. If ever the president wanted to fire nuclear weapons, he would be required first to kill one human being with his own hands. He has to look at someone and know what death is. He pitched this idea to his friends at the Pentagon, and they were like, this is a terrible idea because it would distort the president's judgment and he might not want to push the button.
Oh, really? Watch the plan backfire when Nixon kills multiple people in the first week and doesn't even fire the nukes. LBJ gnaws through some guy's chest.
Everyone's like, can't believe you did that to get the nuclear codes. And he's like, wait, nuclear codes? He just kept interrupting me.
All right, random facts. So he has a quote that I love. I go and look at a stonecutter hammering away at his rock, perhaps 100 times without as much as a crack. Yet at the 101st blow, it will split in two, and I know it was not that last blow that did it, but all that had gone before. And I forgot where I heard this, but it's like when people say, oh, that person's an overnight success, and it's like, no, they probably worked on their craft for years and years, and you're just finally hearing about them.
Yeah, I have this happen after shows where people are like, you are so gifted. And I know it sounds like a compliment, but it's also like, yeah, I've been working on it for 17 years.
If they're gifts, they're ones given to me every single year by the practice fairy.
So my only big complaint about this book is that throughout the book, he tells you to go to his website 16 different times, which is about 15 times more than I see it in other nonfiction books. But I think maybe he's trying to like instill a habit in you within this book about habits. But it's like, could we maybe make this an atomic one?
So I love the point he makes about compound interest. He says, if you can get 1% better each day for 1 year, you'll end up 37 times better by the time you're done. The same way that money multiplies through compound interest, the effects of your habits multiply as you repeat them. Mm. So that's why every day I try to get 1% better at being in the 1%.
So I like how at one point he cites Steve Martin's career trajectory and says, why do some people like Steve Martin stick with habits? But then he doesn't mention that Steve Martin quit stand-up comedy at his peak.
So he tells this cool story about expert intuition, where this woman is a paramedic, and at a family gathering, she sees her father-in-law, and she immediately knows something's wrong, which my dad often has this happen too, and I think it's common with a lot of medical professionals. And she can just tell by the blood distribution in his face that he has an artery blockage. And she ends up quite possibly saving his life by noticing it. But at the party, she goes up to him worried and says, I don't like the way you look. And he says, well, I don't like your looks either. And I wish at that moment she'd been like, never mind, I'm just going to let him die. So he has this idea that I'm still chewing on, where he says, work hard on the things that come easy. Meaning, you know, habits take work, but they're a lot easier if they line up with stuff you're already naturally good at. Like he gives the example, Michael Phelps works really, really hard, but he also has the perfect body for a swimmer. So he chose the right field to work hard on. Mm. So he says, genes do not eliminate the need for hard work. They clarify it. They tell us what to work hard on. And the reason I'm still chewing on it is I'm kind of a deliberate practice absolutist, where I like thinking anyone can get good at anything. And so he may have a point. It's just a point I don't want him to have.
Like that some people could be gifted at comedy.
All right, to recap, our 5 favorite lessons from Atomic Habits. 1, make the good habit easier to do. 2, focus on your trajectory, not the results. 3, make the bad habit harder to do. 4, better to do less than you hoped for than nothing at all. 5, use social pressure.
And 6, if you have any questions, go to atomichabits.com/questions.